This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Melissa Maloof sat down to write about Alice Clark's journey across the country, she tried to ride along with her. Her protagonist's trip is as unpredictable as the winding road she traveled. The socially reserved Alice is haunted by a past in which three college friends died young, and she's on her way to confront another friend who might know why. Alice has to solve the mystery of her past to work out the rest of her own story. Author Melissa Maloof is a professor of English and creative writing at Duke University. This is her third book. It's a novel called More Than You Know. And Melissa Maloof joins us again on The State of Things. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be here.
Well, tell us more about Alice. Set her up for us.
Tell you about Alice. At the time that she's... The bulk of the story occurs when she is... As she says, a woman of a certain age. She is a spinster, childless, which is to say she's lonely and has been lonely for a long time. And I think that that may have something to do in part with her not being able to move beyond something that happened when she was a graduate student. And as you said, the death of her, of three very good friends, one of them in particular. She thinks that she was probably in love with, but that's something that she finds out in the course of her journey from, after she retires from California, across the United States to Vermont.
And not the kind of person who we would think once we met, and we do meet her and get to know her very well, and the more you think about it, the less likely it is that Alice is going to take such a trip.
Exactly. She's never... Even been, as she says, though she's grew up in Southern California, she's barely been to the mountains there. Her one trip was out to Catalina. She is completely, in some ways, unprepared for this trip, as she finds out with her very first encounter on her way. She leaves from Southern California and heads for Las Vegas. And she encounters a sort of scary guy on the way there, but that's only the beginning. That's the first of many people that she will meet along this trip who challenge her, help her in some ways to know who she is, puzzle her, and keep her guessing.
Maybe you can read for us a little bit in a passage that I think helps set up her kind of where she is when she takes this journey on, when she begins the journey.
At the beginning?
Yeah.
The statistics say that at not much over 60... I should be too young for all this gnarling in her. She's got terrible arthritis in her hands. Be that as it may, I did a lot of pausing those last few days in Southern California, pausing, remembering, letting bits and pieces look me straight in the eye and speak my need to go at last to Hannah and her husband, to ask them why my friends so incongruously died, to tell me what I didn't do to save them, to tell me why me? Why am I still alive?
Melissa Maloof reading from her third novel, More Than You Know. So this really does set it up. And now we meet Hannah. We should learn a little bit more about her. It starts out like a mystery. Alice has to know about her friend and her relationship with these, what if anything, she had to do with these three deaths. But as you say, it becomes more of an internal journey, too, and a soul search for Alice.
Right. Alice is in graduate school when she meets Hannah Jensen. Hannah is... an international student. She says that she's from Austria. She's small, but as Alice says, she's small, but she's large in personality. Let's put it that way. Alice takes it upon herself to be Hannah's guide. She feels, again, she's by herself. She has her office mates, but Hannah becomes, in a way, her little sister. Not so much little in age, but little as a person that needs Alice to take care of her. And I think partly because Alice first takes on that role with Hannah, she doesn't see the ways in which Hannah is dangerous. And she is.
And she is. And it does dawn on, a dawn might be too not quite the right word, because over the years, as Alice goes back and look at the deaths of these three friends, she becomes to see Hannah's role in this. And in a sense, her own. So tell us about these three friends and how they died and why they're so important to Alice.
I don't want to say too much about why? Because I don't want to give away the plot.
Lots of spoiler alerts.
All right. These friends were, as I said, the three of them and Alice shared an office together. They were all literature majors, maybe not surprisingly. And so they had all of these conversations. They were tight. They got together after school. They were learning how to be teachers together. They were essentially the only friends that the four of them had. The four of them were a group, were a team. And then Hannah enters the scene, and that throws things off balance. And it turns out that within pretty much no time, about a year, these young men, the three young men, all make choices that have something to do, it seems to Alice, with Hannah and her husband, who Hannah herself only refers to as Mr. Jensen. So we have Mr. Jensen, Hannah, and then these three young men make choices that lead to their utter demise.
You know, what's remarkable about this book and what I love about it is you said Alice should have known better. This was a dangerous person and she should have seen it, but she didn't. That's part of her guilt going forward. But all of these revelations, you know, occur to her over time, in real time, as she grows older. And yet it's only by looking back that she can start to contextualize and put things together. So kind of the way you play
Indeed.
With time, we're moving in both directions. She's moving forward in her life, revealing new things, and then having to go backward to see what part they played.
Right. At this moment, she has been, in a sense, finished her dissertation, did become a teacher, taught in a community college, and threw herself into that work. And threw herself into it in such a way that she didn't have to think about the past at all. But now she's retired, and now, in a sense, this is all she can think about, and start to ask herself questions and start to remember the conversations and what she should have heard and didn't hear. One of the things she says as she's going along the way, which seems to me to be an important piece for her entire journey, is this: sometimes becoming enlightened is the same as becoming uneasy. It sometimes has so little to do with light.
Hmm. Which is why I think a lot of us avoid this journey. It turns out it's not going to be the happy, warm place where we sit in the lotus position. It's going to rock us to our souls. That might be awfully uncomfortable.
Indeed.
And if this, lest we think this is a road trip, and it is, which is a sort of quintessential American on-the-road journey, one of the things you do is go from left to right. And you pointed out in one interview, I think, that a lot of those books take us from the east to west, but you decide to take Alice west to east. Was that a conscious decision?
A conscious decision only in the sense that I knew this trip had to start in California. And as I think I have explained before, I have not myself taken this trip. I went to the AAA, got a triptych, and tried to decide. By then, I knew just enough about Alice to know that it would be very difficult for her to drive 10 hours a day. So I had to figure out a trip where she could make long drives, but also get to stops, get to places fairly relatively quickly and keep stops along the way. So that also had something to do with the way I planned out this journey. But the other thing was that I knew that one of the young men goes with the Jensens during the midst of his graduate studies to the East Coast. So that's where she has to go.
And you mentioned triptych and AAA and someone who shouldn't take this on. You set the novel in the 90s,
yes.
Sort of before she might have had a GPS and it would have been
no
much
cell
easier
phone,
for her to go.
No, none of that stuff. As I say, as Alice tells me, her electric pencil sharpener is her favorite contraption.
And you do take us to lots of B&Bs and stops along the way. And I wonder if I can get you to read again. And this is perhaps one of the most mysterious stops on the way. We're gonna move to the B&B where she never sees anybody, just lots of signs. And I think it's kind of a nice passage.
You know, what the first sign she encounters, there's nobody there, but there's a sign sort of in the foyer that says, sign in, choose one of the upstairs rooms. Number two is already occupied. That's it. So she gets into her room in this place. And there's been a little bit of mysterious conversation with a lady. This happens in Utah, and she meets a lady in a small grocery store and has a mysterious conversation with her before she gets here. There was a shower but no tub, so I sat cross-legged on the yellow and white tiles and pretended that the hot shower was a waterfall. Even then, I could still hear the cello. It seemed to be part of the waterfall coming down all over me and into me, and it remained there as I dressed for bed, ate a little, drank a glass of that good red wine, and tried to read one of the guidebooks, but I couldn't, and I couldn't turn on the small television. I could do nothing but listen. It was as if there were no space, not an inch in my head for anything, no memories, no fretting, no images whatsoever, but the grieving of that music. Somewhere in that house, someone was playing that cello as if every note were about something lost and a prophecy of all the losses yet to come, not just his or hers or mine, but everyone's. It put me into a state I do not wish to revisit ever. I'd been listening for an hour, maybe more, when, like a hypnotic, I got up from the four-poster bed and opened the door of my room. I had only one thought. I had to go there. I had to find the cellist and lie down next to the instrument, close enough to drown within that music, to fill myself up with it, let go of everything else. For the first time, and with no second thoughts, no fear, no hesitation, nothing in my mind but going to wherever that music was, I wanted oblivion. I was halfway down the hall when I heard the occupant of number two weeping, a weeping man crying steadily, an intake of breath, then a sob over and over. I listened outside his door enough to know that his was no sudden burst of tears that would soon cease. It was as if he were as full as a bay at high tide, the sounds of his sorrows at the mercy of an unhurried moon.
Melissa Malouf, reading from her latest novel, More Than You Know. It's a beautiful passage, and I have to say, I'm embarrassed that it took me reading a reviewer to make the connection between Alice and Alice in Wonderland. But once I saw that in the review, I said, oh yeah, we have gone down a rabbit hole here. A lot of strange characters and lots of play with the whole notion of how we perceive and remember and consciousness.
Yeah, in the first drafts of this character was not named Alice. That was something I had to find out. I mean, and find out about really, you know, what I was doing. As my students know, when I tell them not to have any ideas when they start to write, and so I don't really have too many ideas either. So it took me a while, though, to find out from this character that this journey was going to be difficult. It was going to be strange. And part of what I mean by strange is that she meets strangers all along. She has nobody to take this trip with, and nobody to call home to. So it's, and once I sort of began to feel that, and certainly once I got to this odd B&B in Utah, I felt the wonder that was surrounding Alice in the course of this journey. And of course, that's when I knew what her name had to be. She's a daughter of that, of Carol's Alice, or great-granddaughter, let's say.
When you talked about your students, you teach English and creative writing at Duke, does that make you nervously self-conscious as a writer, sort of imagining what your students are, how you would have to defend this passage to a student?
Defend the passage?
Yeah, I mean, what if a student said to you, what'd you do this for? And you'd have to say, well, it's obvious, Alice spoke to me or whatever.
Oh, no, I don't think I would say that. But, oh, gosh, I think I would be able, if we had a lot more time, I would be able to talk to them about the processes. And I do tell them that once they have a draft, that draft can start to tell them what it wants. And I don't mean that in any sort of mysterious, weird way. It can say the story really works best when the sentences are long and complicated, or this other story needs fragments, or this story needs more dialogue, or things like that. I mean, you need pages in order to find out what you're doing.
But I also mean, I mean, I found it when I was doing a little stint training journalism, doing journalism training, that I became nervously self-conscious about the practice of my own job as I thought about all of those hard lessons I had been teaching people, and then kind of inspecting the shortcuts that I had learned along the way as a professional. I became much more self-aware of kind of the practice of my own job. And I just wonder if that happens to a writer who also teaches.
Huh.
No, the answer.
That's a good question, Frank.
I think I have my answer. I think I have my answer. Okay. No, and not in your case. Yeah. So you just go ahead and
you know. But partly, I think it's one of you have to have shortcuts because you're always on deadline.
Yeah.
This this, I'm not working on deadline here. So I can have draft after draft after draft and keep going back and even up to the last minutes before Dahlke was publishing this book, there were still, you know, just small things. This needs to be changed.
Were you always confident in Alice? I'll tell you what happened to me as I read the novel. I started out, she was a character. I wanted to follow her. I was pulling for her. As we got deeper and she met more and more characters, I began to wonder, even in the beginning with this B&B, if she was reliable. And I wondered to what extent I should trust what was coming out of her mouth and what was coming out of her mind. And by the end of the book, she became a real objective character. I mean, there was one moment in the book where I thought, there is no Hannah. There is nobody at the other end of this. Now, ultimately, things changed for me. But
I think that's a really interesting idea because you make Alice actually far more complicated and maybe ill.
She seemed that way to me. Was she ever that way to you? Did you trust her the whole time, or were there moments when you began to wondered about her sanity?
I think I trusted her, but I also was very interested in her weaknesses and her failures of imagination. And partly those failures, in a way, I'm glad she wasn't able to imagine the sexual complexities of the Jensen's relationship with the three young men that were her friends. I'll just put it that way. I'm glad she wasn't able to imagine that, but also damn her for not being able to imagine that, because she might have been able to intervene. So I think I trusted her, pitied her. There is one point, and maybe this is one of the points when you thought Alice is not who she seems to be, when very openly when she goes to a bar in Denver and she explicitly lies to the bartender for no good reason about who she is.
Yeah.
There really isn't a reason for her to say that she's there on business. And that just comes out of the blue. And that's one of those moments, I think, when she simply, first of all, I think, and the question of trust, she doesn't trust herself.
Hmm. What about Hannah? Because, again, I there was a point in the book where I thought there was no Hannah. She does come to, as a real objective character by the end. And one that is fully drawn, and characters I think we've all met, deeply manipulative, pathologically so. Was Hannah full drawn for you when the novel began, or did she evolve?
She definitely evolved. I mean, I think I had a clear image of her. I had a picture in my mind of what this young woman looked like and how adorable she was. And that adorability is partly what is dangerous about her, because it allows her to manipulate the people that she wants to in very different ways. At one point, she comes into the office and says, for another class, she's written a one-act play in which she wants her friends to have roles. And these roles are all sort of insinuating something about each of about Alice, about her three friends. They're unkind.
Melissa, it is always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Frank.
Melissa Maloof, an English and creative writing professor at Duke University. Her book is called More Than You Know. Just ahead, the music of the Chompy Quartet. Stay tuned.